Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're 6 months into the Trump administration with some key science positions unfilled, like the directors for NASA and NOAA. One important job was filled today. Georgia Public Health Commissioner Brenda Fitzgerald was chosen as the new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But there are still 45 Senate-confirmed science positions that still sit unfilled, according to reports. The staff at the Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP, has been reduced down to a third. And one of the biggest unknowns is who will become the science advisor. The person who fills this role will have a direct line to the president. How can or will science policy move forward with these vacancies in top spots, and what's the holdup? My next guests are here to talk us and walk us through this. Neil Lane is a former science advisor to President Clinton. He's also senior fellow in science and technology policy at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston. Welcome back to Science Friday, Neil.
Thank you, Ira. Very nice to be on your show.
Sarah Reardon is a biomedical research and policy reporter at Nature News in Washington. Sarah, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you first, can you give us a quick background about Brenda Fitzgerald, Dr. Fitzgerald?
Yeah, she is the health commissioner, or was the health commissioner in Georgia, which of course is where the CDC is based. And she was an OBGYN by training, and people seem to like her quite a lot. She's gotten a lot of public health experts commenting this morning that this is a very good, solid choice for this position.
Are you surprised at that choice?
Well, it's been kind of a mix so far among the science positions that Trump has appointed. He's had some people that are very popular, very well qualified. For instance, he kept on Francis Collins as director of the National Institutes of Health. He was he's a geneticist. He's been director under Obama. He was very popular in Congress, and I think a lot of people think he's done a really good job. On the other hand, a lot of people sort of bristled at the appointment of people like Rick Perry, Texas governor, as the Department of Energy head, whereas that person before had been a physicist, Perry didn't necessarily have the same scientific expertise. So I think it's been a bit of a mixed bag as far as the scientific background of the people that Trump's appointed.
Right. Neil, let's talk about not just the director, there are other key appointments left unfilled.
Well, I agree about keeping on Francis Collins. I think he was also head of the International Human Genome Project back in the Clinton days. So, been an outstanding public servant. And also, Franz Cordova continues, I believe, at National Science Foundation, NSF director, has a term of 6 years. But of course, the president can make changes if he wishes to do so. So I think the situation is mixed. I agree. And there are some very good people staying on, fortunately. There are still people in OSTP, scientists, who will continue to do the work of the office in spite of the fact that the three scientists in the science division have moved on to other positions that I understand were that was a planned move some time ago. But that office is pretty thin right now, as you point out. So. It's a key office in the White House, and it's a key interface for many of these other agencies, and that's a problem for them right now.
Why do you think that no science advisor has been appointed at this point?
I don't know, of course, what's in the president's mind. We know publicly, at least, that two and perhaps more have been interviewed and have spoken with the president, but he did not appoint them. Many months have gone on since that time, so I'm not sure whether the issue is they simply do not have the kind of background that he's interested in. If the president wants to focus in particular areas, I understand right now there are priorities placed on cybersecurity. That's understandable. Information technology. It's like it could be that he's looking for someone with particular niche expertise, but there could also be other issues that have to do with politics or ideology. I simply don't know.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, what about the other people who are still the positions that are still open? Not at the highest level. There are still key appointments missing.
As you mentioned in your intro, NASA, as well as then National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which does a lot of the weather tracking, among other things, U.S. Geological Survey, don't have directors. Neither do many of the other agencies have a lot of the key science positions filled. For instance, Department of Energy, as I mentioned before, the Environmental Protection Agency, DOD, the Department of Defense, they all have science advisors within those, advisors to the directors of those agencies, and most of those positions are unfilled as well at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Neil, do you see issues that might come up or have come up that really need some advice that's missing?
Well, so many of the policy issues that the president deals with on a daily basis, but also the more strategic ones, have science or technological implications. And right now, it's just not clear where he would be getting advice. So even things like the immigration ban has implications for American science and the enterprise, and not just the research side, but also on the private sector. It would be very good if the president had access to information about those implications of such policies. Things that are going on in the Environmental Protection Agency, I mean, the rollback of many of the regulations or the attempt to roll them back, methane being one of the more recent ones, those policy decisions have significant implications for energy, of course, and the environment, but workforce issues and the economy and so forth. To the extent that science and technology is important, and it is in those cases, the president needs somebody he can get a straight story from. I mean, someone who's not in any way biased by the fact that they run an agency or they have a particular constituency to worry about. He needs somebody he can trust who will give him the straight story about what the science is and what the technical capability mm-hmm. is of a move one way or another.
Sarah, so where is President Trump getting his science advice from now?
I don't think people really know. According to a lot of the folks I've spoken to at OSTP or who have recently left OSTP, he's not been getting a lot of it from them. There have been a lot of rumors and speculation that Silicon Valley capital investor Peter Thiel, he's been sort of an informal, semi-formal advisor to the president throughout his campaign and through the transition. A lot of people have said that he's got the president's ear in a lot of science-related issues. And the one indication that that's true is that the one person who has been appointed by Trump to the Office of Science Technology Policy was Peter Thiel's former chief of staff, a man named Michael Kratsios. And he is sort of at a mid-level politically appointed position right now. He's the deputy chief technology officer. And that's the only person that Trump has put in. We don't really know. He's probably talking with folks from industry. He's probably talking with his political advisors.
Yeah. Neil, while some of these agencies wait for their directors to be named, there are acting officers. It's not completely empty. Can a non-permanent acting officer suffice?
Well, it's a different kind of a job. There are really top-notch people in all these agencies who take on these acting roles in a time when the position is open. And, of course, they keep the trains running on time and make sure the agency is following the rules and delivering on its products. But you really can't expect somebody in an acting position to take initiative to push forward on policy directions that he or she may feel are important, even those that have been fully vetted inside the agency are sort of teed up, ready to go. The person in an acting position understands that he or she is not really expected to do that. At least that's my view. There's some really good people, but it's a very different job.
Do you think that these slow appointments are a way of signaling a disinterest in science by the administration?
Well, the president's not said a lot about science. When he was running, he didn't have much to say about science, except science that's politically polarized, climate change, for example. And he hadn't said much since. I can only guess, because I don't have inside information, that the White House has been rather distracted by a number of other issues, and they're very important also. And it shouldn't necessarily be interpreted as anti-science in some general sense, but rather it would be pretty clear that science is not a particularly high priority at this time for the White House.
So you're just saying they're disorganized. If they forget to make a reservation at the G20 meeting for a hotel, why should you expect them to be more organized?
Well, you can't do everything.
I mean. And it sounds funny, but it's not really a laughing matter, Sarah, is it?
Well, no. There's always the possibility that something is going to happen. The thing that everyone's concerned about is that there's going to be a disaster or another Gulf oil spill or an Ebola outbreak or something like that, where the president's not going to necessarily have someone to turn to for scientific advice. And just to add on to what Dr. Lane was just saying, with the slowness to appoint an advisor, it's kind of a thing across the government. Trump has only appointed a very small fraction of the total number of people in any area. It's not necessarily science that's being singled out. And that's kind of been the case on his advisory councils as well. He's going to have to, if there were such a disaster, he would have to weigh advice from national security experts, from economists, from political experts, as well as a scientist, and make a decision based on off of those. But it's not clear how many of those people are in place right now. And I think that there's concern that there would be knee-jerk or ill-informed decisions made unless they've got some people in there who really know what they're talking about.
Last quick question, Neil. What about if the president appoints a science advisor who has questionable views about climate change? Would that really set a theme?
Well, of course, that would upset many people in the science community, but I think John Holdren, President Obama's science advisor, who's served longer than any of the previous science advisors and is an expert in areas of energy and climate change and also national security and now many other things. But I recall him on public record just saying, look, it's so important you get a science advisor who understands science, at least, and the importance of the federal investment research and so forth. So even if
Neil,
they take a different position, yeah, we can live with that.
Neil Lane and Sarah Reardon, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take
a
break.
It's a pleasure.
You're welcome. We're going to talk about Skyping a scientist. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you'll indulge me for a second, I want you to close your eyes and picture a scientist, right? If you picture the Hollywood version, you see the typical scientist, white lab coat, geeky, crazy hair. There's always a Bunsen burner, right, with some green liquid in the background, isn't there? Well, if you listen to this show, you know that vision is pretty outdated and inaccurate, and that scientists do a whole lot of different things, from researching the fluid dynamics of ketchup to the microbiome of squid to designing high-tech wheels for the next Mars rover. And my next guest wanted to represent that diversity of people and interests and areas of expertise and just get the message out, scientists are people. Now, what's the best way to do it? How about talking to kids? Her program is called Skype a Scientist, and it's already connected real scientists with over 800 classrooms around the world. Sarah McAnulty is the founder of Skype as Scientist. She's a PhD candidate in the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology, University of Connecticut. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what's the idea behind the program? Basically to network kids with scientists via Skype?
Yeah, exactly. So effectively, I match scientists with K through 12 classrooms for question and answer sessions with the scientist. And these sessions can cover the scientist's area of study, or it can be a general discussion of what it's like to be a scientist. And the teachers can choose what kind of scientist they want to talk to. So for example, if you have a chemistry class, they can talk to a chemist. An elementary school class can talk to someone who works with animals. And I also try to match classrooms that identify themselves as having students from underrepresented groups with scientists from the same ethnic or socioeconomic group, so that the students can interact with a scientist that they can really easily relate to.
So how far has the program spread? Have you been able to get scientists into classrooms in some of those hard-to-reach areas?
We have. So it's pretty crazy. As you said, we've reached 800 classrooms last semester, and we've had 500 sign up so far for the fall. And we've reached 47 of the 50 states and 28 different countries. And these aren't all just in metropolitan areas. We've gotten to rural areas as well, which is pretty exciting.
You're pretty shocked yourself, you must be, about how well this, how successful you've been.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is it possible to, by Skyping with a scientist, to push back on biased textbooks, you know, where the, you might have creationism being taught in science classrooms?
Yeah, I wonder if we would even get classrooms signing up from those schools. I mean, if you have a teacher that doesn't approve maybe of the textbooks that they're using, they could get a real scientist in the class to debunk the kind of stuff that they might be seeing. But we haven't had any major pushback from principals or anything yet, but that would be a way that we could help out.
There was a really exciting moment on Twitter a couple of months ago. So many different types of scientists from all over the country were tweeting with the actual living scientist hashtag. What was that in response to?
So many scientists have just sort of felt like there are a couple scientist celebrities kind of that have surfaced. So, of course, Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson. And there was another one of these Twitter campaigns called Bill Nye Meet Science Twitter. And this was very similar to actual living scientists. And the real goal of these kinds of things is just to show people what the diversity of scientists that are out there. So just like you said in the opening, you have these pictures of scientists, like kooky white men with crazy hair. And we want people to see that really scientists are just regular people, and we have hobbies just like everyone else. There are a number of hashtags, like there was scientists who do yoga and scientists who brew beer and all this sort of things, just to show that we have hobbies like everyone else, and we're just not as pretentious as we may seem in movies.
Yeah, because if you believe the movie stereotypes, it's kind of amazing what you come up with. Of course, our segment really couldn't be complete if we didn't Skype a scientist ourselves. And we have tried to do so, believe me. But our Skype doesn't want to talk to their Skype. So we're going to bring...
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're going to bring Emily Green in by telephone. She is a PhD student in microbiology at the University of Connecticut, too. And she joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I know you participated in the Skype a Scientist program. How was it? What classroom did you meet? Tell us about your experience.
Yeah, so about in the spring semester, Sarah got the Skype a Scientist all set up. And so the classroom I was paired with was in a rural part of Vermont. And I contacted that teacher, and she's taught 7th and 8th grade science for that school. And as we were talking, it was realizing that I had a lot in common with these kids. I'm from a small town in central Ohio, and so it was neat to be able to connect with these kids and sort of show them my path into a PhD here in Connecticut, and show them that even though they're from a small area, that there's so much out there, and even just so much in science that they can start looking at and get interested in.
Did you think you changed their minds about what a scientist is and can do?
I think so. They were super into asking questions about the organism I study, about the ants that my lab is studying, and I feel like they realized being a scientist wasn't, as Sarah was mentioning, something that's in the movies, but we're real people and we can do other things outside of the lab that we're in.
Were they able to get a new appreciation for the ants also when you talk?
I think they were. They were pretty interested. What was awesome about doing this Skyping is that I can show them the colonies. And so I'm able to take them around the lab, and they're able to see the people that I'm working with as well as the neat little creatures I get to study. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask both you, Emily, and Sarah a question. Are we living in an era of so-called alternative facts, science deniers that think climate change is a hoax, vaccines are evil, and so on? And as we just heard in the previous segment, scientific advisors are being neglected in Washington. How does this program fit into that landscape?
So I think being able to reach out to the younger generations right now is so important. Getting them to realize what science is all about and not believing the unfortunate things that are going on in the media and the press. I think this gives them a chance to see the truth and be able to rely on their teachers for that scientific information.
Sarah?
Yeah, I agree with Emily. And also, I think it's really important for us to make emotional connections with people. And I think if you have these personal experiences with students or with adults, it really helps them foster trust in you as a person and not just this imaginary science that they have in their head. I think a lot of times people might also, not in addition to the mad scientist stereotype, might also have this, like, on the internet, you hear about scientists being funded by corporations and lying to the public. And if you meet us, you realize it's not really what's going on. And I think that helps a lot. And I think also when you talk to a bunch of kids, they can maybe bring it home and talk about it with their parents, which could help. So this is an interesting way that you could approach this pretty big problem.
Okay, so we have scientists now listening to, I'm sure we do, our program. How can a scientist sign up? How can they get on with your program?
Yeah, we'd love to have help from scientists, and we'd love to have teachers sign up as well. So all you have to do is go to www.skypeascientist.com, and there will be sign-up forms and more information for both teachers and scientists. And we'd love to have you.
Are you able to handle the flood that's going to come your way? Yeah,
I certainly hope so. I have a software engineer named Dinesh who's been helping me auto-match the program so that I don't have to sit there and match individually, which has been super helpful. Thanks, Dinesh. Yeah, so we should be all right. Yeah. We should be able to handle it.
And Emily, are you going to continue talking to the kids?
I absolutely am. I'm looking forward to the fall. I'm actually going to be working with that same teacher and hopefully many more teachers all across the U.S. and the globe.
Well, I wish you both good luck, and check in with us again, would you?
Sure. Thanks.
Sarah McAnulty, founder of Skype a Scientist, PhD candidate at the University of Connecticut. Emily Green is also a PhD candidate at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. I want to thank both of them for joining us today. Summer is here, and if it's not too darn hot today, you know it's bound to be again soon, sometime, because as the mercury rises, you know, what's the last thing you want to do? See, it's hot. It's hot in the kitchen. You don't want to spend your afternoons next to a hot oven or with four pots boiling on a stove. Maybe you don't even have the space for barbecuing. So what's the solution? Well, for some, it's a lot more salads and sandwiches and maybe ice cream for dinner. But what if you could cook up something tasty without using heat? That was a bit more interesting than maybe using, you know, just having ice cream. There is a trick. There are lots of tricks we're going to talk about on how to cook without the heat, maybe using a bit of lime juice or a lot of salt or other tricks of science. Well, you're interested? It's time for a special no-heat edition of our Food Failures series. And if you want to, you want your tricks too, do you have a favorite no-heat cooking technique or recipe? We want to hear about it. You can give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. I have a tray full of wonderful, cold, delicious-looking food here. Sitting across from me is Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food As I say, he's here in our New York studios. Welcome back to Science Friday, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
You can cook without heat.
Well, depends on your definition of cook, but if you consider it preparing food, yes. And what I brought you today is probably the strangest lunch of all. Salmon gravlax, some beef jerky, ceviche, and salt-preserved lemons.
Mmm.
Well, it doesn't exactly go all together by itself,
but
they're all great examples of things we can do.
A lot of good grazing here. Now, let's talk first about why heat is such a crucial part of cooking in the first place.
Well, there's really two reasons that we cook food in terms of putting heat on it. One is for textural changes and things that make the food more delicious. So think about that steak that's seared and has those nice brown Maillard reaction aromas. But the second reason is around the safety aspects. And heat really turns out to be a fantastic way to kill those pathogens that might make you sick.
Right. Yeah, that's, you know, makes it easier to digest, but you have to kill off the baddies.
You got to kill, right.
if we're looking to eat without heat, what do we need to do to make it then safe?
So, yeah, if we're talking about the pathogens and kind of the aspect of safety, pathogens themselves have a couple of different variables that are important for them to be able to thrive and survive. There's this lovely acronym, FAT-TOM, where each letter stands for something that is important for microbial growth. I won't rattle through all of them, but the lemon and lime juice is the A and the fat, which is acidity. So the pH range is really important. And then there's things like oxygen. Obviously, bacteria and microbes have to be able to go through respiration, or in some cases anaerobic without it. And there's also things like the M in fat, Tom, actually, moisture, another really important concept. And that's where our beef jerky comes into play.
All right. We want to hear from you if you'd like to take part in heatless cooking, 844-724-8255. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. Okay, let's start with acidity. Can I dunk my burger in vinegar, you know, to make it safe to eat?
I don't know about dunking a burger in hamburgers are ground meat.
Right.
And the issue there is that essentially it's all outside. So if we're talking about beef, the issue there is any surface contamination that might come up during slaughtering. Mm-hmm. And when you grind it, that surface contamination, well, hamburgers, all ground beef. So if you're to dunk it in vinegar or lime juice, you're only actually coating the outside at that point. But if you took something that was not ground, where the surface had some contamination, and you dipped that into something very acidic, that would take care of surface contamination. And with something like a whole muscle intact steak, the interior is considered generally sterile, so that actually would take care of it. And there are some dishes in some cultures where you take beef and you actually marinate them in something that's very acidic.
Give me an example. You brought something with you that's been cooked with acid.
Well, in this case, the scallops are in lime juice. Mm. So these scallops are previously frozen, which means anything that might be in the interior in terms of parasites would be killed by the freezing process. And then the outside has been soaked in lime juice. In this case, scallops actually take quite a long time to really do much of anything, so a couple hours. Other kinds of fish, saltwater fish, actually can kind of go faster, 30 minutes, maybe an hour. So in this case, it's really about the food item, what pathogens might be present on that food item, and then what technique can we use to render those pathogens mostly safe.
So by definition, I'm looking at it looks like a raw scallop. In terms of it's not being cooked on a flame.
It's not been cooked with heat.
Right.
Now, this goes into the definition.
Should I give it a try?
Yeah, go for it. This gets into the definition of what does cooked mean, and that's more of a linguistic question, less of a science one. In this case, the acids are taking, and that's very acidic, it's just straight up lime juice. I didn't add any cilantro or onions as I might normally.
Delicious.
So in this case, you need about 15% of lime juice or lemon juice or vinegar by weight, kind of to make sure you have a sufficiently acidic environment. But yeah, it's basically taking the proteins on the outside and denaturing them, changing the way they, you know, are structured. And that, of course, would also denature any bacteria that might be on the outside.
Mm-hmm. I make pickles at home, but I ferment the pickles. Is that sort of cooking them, fermentation?
Yeah, sure, definitely. In that case, what you're doing is you're introducing a particular not a pathogen, but a particular bacteria, and letting it go to town. And that particular strain is going to essentially prevent other things from coming in and kind of taking over. That's a fascinating question for somebody in the fungal, fungal area in terms of the science of that.
Like that's something that's going on anaerobically because it has to be under the brine there that I have. So it's an anaerobic. There's so many things. I want to get to all the food on the tray here, so I'm not going to start because we have to go to a break. But we're talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. If you have a recipe or something you'd like to suggest that you make without using a flame or very low cooking, give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking about ways to cook your food without using heat or a very tiny amount of heat. You know, it's a sweaty midsummer edition of Food Failures where we try to keep the kitchen as livable as we can. If it's not hot where you are now, you will thank us later. Yes. Yeah, summers are getting hotter. My guest is Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. And I just finished sampling something that was soaked in lime juice, right, for a while. It was delicious.
Thank you.
And that was, so that's very acidic. What about going in the other direction, something very alkaline?
So we don't have too many foods that really use things that are particularly basic. Most foods happen to basically be acidic. The few cases I could really find were things that involved lye. So century eggs use lye to actually pull up the pH to, you know, 9 to 12, that high actually. And then you've got things like there's this Norwegian fish. I can never say the name. Lutefisk?
Lutefisk.
Lutefisk.
Oh, I spent a lot of time in Minnesota.
So
I think it's buried in the ground. It's very actually treated with lye. Absolutely. And I've had lutefisk. And let me be kind about it and say you have to. It's an acquired taste.
There are a couple of dishes around the world that are acquired. Iceland is famous for its buried shark. And I would say between eating something like buried shark or lutefisk versus starving, I would probably take, you know, the food even if it's got strange things. Lutefisk was really funny. I was trying to dig into more about what happens to the science. We don't know so much, but one thing I did find was that in the Wisconsin statutes, they specifically define toxic substances and they exclude lutefisk. It's actually in their list.
Wow. Well, let me tell you, we have big audience in Minnesota. We're going to hear today.
I want to know where that comes from. How did that rider get added? It's in the regulation of industry, billions, and safety. It's down there. It says lutefisk. Like,
we will. I tell you, we're going to hear it today and many times maybe. Let's go to Ryan in Provo, Utah. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask Jeff if he's looked into cured egg yolks.
I actually have a cured egg yolk sitting in my fridge right now at home. I forgot to bring in for this.
What is a cured egg yolk for we novices?
So you can take an egg yolk and basically drop it into salt. You surround it in salt, get a cup, put a half inch of salt in the bottom, put the egg yolk in, cover it with another half inch of salt, let that sit in your fridge for about a week or so. You can let it go 2 weeks, and you'll get something which is cured yolk. The salt's drawing out a lot of the moisture, reducing the available moisture in the egg from a pathological point of view, but it also changes the texture, changes the flavors. I'm told at 2 weeks in, you get something that's kind of vaguely like Parmesan, strangely.
Right, Ryan, do you have some?
We experimented with that at a restaurant where I cook, and he's right on in saying it's kind of like a Parmesan where you can shave it over food.
I've had it that way. It's fantastic.
We threw in some aromatics. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I've had it that way, and it's fantastic. Now, you're starting to say aromatics. What else are you doing with it? Because I don't know what to do with the egg yolk I've got at home besides, you know, shave it slightly onto salad.
That's why I was curious what you had been doing. We threw in some thyme and rosemary, and I had read about it in a book, and I was kind of wanting to learn more because, you know, the chefs I worked with hadn't really done much with it, but it had a really interesting flavor, just sort of like enriched and concentrated that yolk kind of buttery umami flavor.
Wow.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Jeff, taking notes here. So,
third edition, right?
good luck, Ryan. Thanks for sharing that hint for us. I never heard of that.
It's really cool, actually. Yeah. There's something about the concentration process that changes the flavors, not just concentrates them, but it actually from what I understand, does something to allow additional new flavor compounds to come about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to my tray here because I want to get to some of these tasty-looking things. There's beef jerky there. What does that symbolize?
Well, that's when I said Fat Tom earlier, that's the M in moisture. And with beef jerky, what we're doing is removing as much moisture as possible to get what's called the water activity, which is a measure of the amount of available moisture, to get that water activity down low enough. And it's basically a way of preserving. If there's not water available for microbes to grow, well, then they don't grow.
I grossed out a lot of people last week chewing, so I'm not going to do that again.
So there's two pieces there.
No, I just had a piece. I turned the mic off. It was really good. It's salty.
Yeah.
Right? Is that part of the dehydration process?
Salt helps the proteins in the meat tissue bond to more of the water. So when I talk about moisture and water activity, it's really about how much water is available. And the salt there is allowing the proteins to hold onto more of the moisture, making it not available. So it is related. It's not necessarily a specific salinity that's required, but it helps.
It's good. And how much is dehydrating a common way of storing food or preparing it if you're not heating it?
Well, it depends on what you think of in terms of foods that are dehydrated. Are spices dehydrated? They certainly are. And almost anybody who's a regular cook has got something at home in their cupboard that's dehydrated in that sense. Depends on where you are in the world and culture as well.
Well, we have on our website at sciencefriday.com/jerky. We have more tips and tricks on the beef jerky from Cooking for Geeks on our website, sciencefriday.com/jerky. Lots of people calling in with other kinds of advice, other tips. Let's see if we can get one. Charles in New Haven. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Hey there. Go ahead.
So I have a bit of a funny story, and then it turns into a better recipe from there.
Go for it.
The funny story is back in undergrad, my background as a chemist, a chemistry major. We used to have what we called lab sprouts, which is a terrible idea, but was always fun at parties. And what lab sprouts was is we'd take a Ziploc bag, gallon Ziploc bag, we'd drop, you know, all the fixings you have for Brussels sprouts, you know, the sprouts themselves and whatever you wanted to them, and then we'd leave them soaking for a long time in lab-grade acetic acid. And for those of you that aren't quite familiar with what acetic acid is, all your vinegar is 5% acetic acid by weight. So it's a concentrated, basically, form of vinegar. And we just sort of let it stew in that for a long, long time.
How long is long?
Yeah,
is that a week? Is that a year?
Ira and I are looking at each other here going, okay, what's long?
I think we once had a three-monther where we let it sit for a while.
Now, okay, I'm now curious. What does this do to the Brussels sprouts? Because that seems intense. And we're talking like glacial acetic acid?
Yep, 100%.
Oh.
No, not 100%.
That's 100%. Yeah. That's, wow.
Not 100%, but yeah.
Really close. Acid. You can't actually quite get to 100.
No.
And very, what does it taste like when you take it out after 3 months? What does it taste like?
Sour is the wrong word for it, but it is the chemical equivalent of a sour punch in the face.
So it was more sour than sour.
Yes, exactly. It's like if you got sour down to just what the chemical equivalent of it was, that's what it tastes like.
I'm going to go on record here and suggest this does not sound like a good practice for other listeners to try.
Don't try this at home.
You had mentioned you had a recipe or something that came out of this.
Yeah, so I don't know if you guys are at all familiar with what a switchel is. A switchel is a process where you take a sugary syrup and you take a vinegar. Frequently, it's apple cider syrup and apple cider vinegar, and you make it a very concentrated vinegar. So it is high in that acetic acid. And you basically mix it together and let it sit for a while until it becomes this incredibly potent, like, construct. And then once you have that, you can do a lot of stuff with it. You can dilute it to make, you know, a base for drinks. You can turn it into an oil and vinegar sort of salad dressing, or you can stew vegetables in it. You can you can add just a little bit of heat, or you can just add herbs, spices, salt, and you can let the sort of flavor soak into it. And it's much less a novelty, you know, party trick than lab sprouts were.
I'll have to look that up. It makes me think of shrubs and drinks. Concentrated.
Yeah. Well, you see, you've put your chemistry background to good use, making good food. So, hope you. Thank you
I appreciate that.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Have a good weekend. Yeah, so there's this interesting stuff going on.
It never ceases to amaze me the things that people are willing to guinea pig on themselves when it comes to things they'll cook in their kitchen and try.
Now, you asked for what can we do with the eggs. Remember, we were doing, what else can I do with the eggs, you ask.
Yeah.
You ask our listeners, they respond. Let's go
Thank
to Pittsburgh.
You, listeners.
Dawn in Pittsburgh, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
I'm Chinese. Cured eggs is like a very traditional thing. We typically use duck eggs. That's even better than chicken eggs. The way that you described is actually is an accelerated way to cure it, which is great. So what we use that, I'm going to give three examples. One would be fried rice. So you just kind of sprinkle it when you do fried rice. That'll, you know, add a little bit of a like salty umami flavor. And another thing we use is to, when you steam white fish, so you would use some of that to kind of get the flavor, you know, out better. Another thing that I would use is grilled vegetables. So let's say you grow zucchini, eggplant, and then, because I guess we don't typically grill, but I can see grill would translate well. Using some of that on top of the grilled vegetables.
So a question for you. When you're talking about cured eggs, you're referring to century eggs?
No, not that.
Okay. Okay, so you're talking about cured eggs as cured in salt as opposed to the live-based process.
Cured in salt, yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Not that we call it, I know, thousand-year-old eggs, cured, dark, not that.
The danger of talking about food is it makes me really hungry. So now I'm going to go home. I actually have
I'm going to give you some of this.
I've got some rice at home in my fridge that I actually fried up for lunch today. And I should have thought. Now I've got the ingredients for this in my fridge. So I love these tips.
I got to give him some food here. I got to feed him. So thanks for calling.
Okay.
I have Gravlax here. And why is Gravlax representative? Except that it's just cold. It's cold salmon, right?
It's cold salmon that's been pressed in. It's got a salt cure on it, so it's actually similar. I'll warn you, mine's a little salty. So I'm glad you got a cup of water there. So it's actually very similar in the process of jerky in the sense that it's removing moisture. So in the case of beef jerky, when you put it into a dehydrator, you're mechanically removing it, letting it sublimate out. In the case of salt, you're removing available moisture by adding in salt that absorbs water, preventing it from being accessible to other microbes. In the case of Gravlax, you know, historically, you could imagine being in a fishing village where you caught some fish and you want to go a couple of days inland. It's not going to last as long as the beef jerky. Well, none of this lasts very long because I eat it too fast. But in case of the Gravlax, it's not going to last for days and days. You know, it's something you can make, put in your fridge, use it within a week. The beef jerky with proper heat processing on it can actually last years.
I mean, years.
Theoretically. Yeah. The food safety people don't say years, but there's nothing that should be problematic there.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with author, cook, and a great food expert, Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. Now my salivary glands are working over time. That really was salty, but it was delicious.
Yeah. A little bit of dill. I put a little vodka in there. It's a solvent.
I see. Of course. It's medicinal. Let's say you just want to stick with the old-fashioned salad. I want to stick with a salad. Can you help us make a perfect dressing for that?
Oh, Lordy, I think a perfect dressing depends upon what you like in your salad.
Just a little bit of balsamic vinegar will do it.
I mean, I personally, this is a very, maybe it's a good food answer, not a very interesting science answer. Personally, I just do a little bit of olive oil, oregano, and some dried oregano. It's actually really good.
Well, let's talk about things that people eat that are raw, and then why are they safe? For example, why is beef tartare safe to eat, or even sushi? Why is that safe to eat?
So this goes back to what's the food product? What are the sources of safety issues around them, whether they be endemic in wherever the food's from or introduced in post-harvest, and then how it's handled. In the case of something like sushi or beef tartare, the things that we typically use for those dishes are animals that don't have particular issues. So there's a reason why we don't typically see things like, I don't know, cod sushi. Not that it can't be done, but if you look at most species of, many species of tuna, for example, don't generally have parasites, and they don't have things like E. coli or Salmonella. If you look at something like beef tartare, you can have surface contamination. So if I was going to try to make somebody a really nice steak tartare,
yeah.
I would actually, and I was, you know, wanting to be a little more careful than normal, recognizing that there's always some risk in, mm-hmm. in these sorts of things. I would actually dip it in very hot water, not quite boiling, you know, call it 180, 185 degrees for 10, 20 seconds. And what that's going to do is reduce most of the surface contamination that might exist in terms of E. coli down to a level that's unlikely to cause problems. Mm-hmm. And then the interior of that muscle in the case of steak is considered generally sterile. So it's kind of a what's the feed product, what's the technique you're using, how do you match the right processes up so mm-hmm. that it's safe?
Let's say that you really have to cook something, you know, because you just don't like to eat raw stuff or whatever, and you want to keep the kitchen as cool as possible. What's the best way to cook? You want to cook something.
Like yeah.
I mean, is there a pot you should use or any sort of thing?
I would actually tackle it by thinking about traditions of different cultures. This is probably more of an anthropological answer, but if you look at cultures that are closer towards the equator, where cooking with a lot of heat is not something that they're going to want to do, so actually things like stir fries as opposed to roasts, you know,
or a pressure cooker, right?
Cooker. So if we want to bring the science in, the pressure cooker part is actually really fun because increasing pressure increases the rate of reactions. So if you take something, let's say you did want to make that roast I mentioned a minute ago in the middle of summer, but you don't want your oven on for 6 or 8 hours or whatever. If you do it in a pressure cooker where your temperature can get up to about 240 degrees, and that's based on increased pressure, mm-hmm. so you can have increased boiling point, so the rest of the muscle tissue can get hotter in that environment, things like the breakdown of collagen will occur much, much faster. So what might normally take 6 hours, you know, might take an hour or two or half an hour, depends on the exact details of the food. So
yeah, that's good. That's a good solution.
Yeah, it's definitely the modern thing.
Yeah, yeah. And then if you want to know more great tips from Jeff, he's got a book out called Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, Good Food. Jeff Potter, always great to have you.
Thank you.
Here with us and bringing me my dinner tonight, because I'm sure that's what it's going to be. And if you want to tackle dessert, did you know that chocolate is a crystal? Today is actually the International Chocolate Lovers Day. And chocolate is a crystal. You can test it out in your very own kitchen, courtesy of the Science Friday Educate team. Head over to sciencefriday.com/chocolate to try it. Bon appetit. To me, every day is a chocolate day. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Hope I didn't gross you out with chewing today too much. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.